Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I start today's program with some cheery news, and the happy prospect an anniversary today provides for the very near future. 46 years ago, on October 10th, 1973, Spiro Agnew resigned as vice president to an already troubled Richard Nixon. Agnew pleaded no contest to tax evasion charges in exchange for charges of political corruption being dropped. Nixon resigned as president less than a year later. Also today, 58 years ago, on 10/10/1961, a natural disaster occurred that foreshadows today's program. The entire population of a small South Atlantic Ocean island of Tristan were evacuated to England when the volcano that forms the island erupted. Most of the evacuees chose to return home to Tristan 2 years later. And now, Saturday is Columbus Day, 527. I have scribbled a potpourri of stuff around that anniversary, and I call it Columbus on the Columbia. A renaissance of Western civilization, a rebirth of classical knowledge, culminated in the late 15th century with the calamitous error of Christopher Columbus, who stumbled upon the Western Hemisphere while seeking ocean passage to the Far East. Columbus missed his mark by half a world, and by that doubled the world's size. But he refused to believe that he had blundered upon an entirely unknown landmass that blocked his passage to India and China. Immediately, Columbus began the cruel harvest of native inhabitants that was to last the better part of four centuries. As Native Americans on both continents, North and South, perished by millions from forced labor, slaughter, disease, and despair, it seemed as though half of Africa was emptied to provide slaves for New World plantations and for slave labor in gold and silver mines, and millions died before reaching the Americas. 2 centuries later, the great thinkers of the 18th century Enlightenment debated the consequences of the European discovery of the American continents and concluded the costs had been too high for the gains. The dispute between 18th century intellectuals such as Rousseau, Voltaire, et al. Argued that millions of native lives had been lost or enslaved, and wholesale destruction of native culture by the European encounter was a blight upon the history of civilization. The great thinkers wished Columbus, the great navigator, had sailed off the end of the world. And Columbus might himself wished he never sailed either. He died poor and in disgrace. New civilizations spawned upon the ruins of the obliterated, often deeply influenced by them. And one in particular emerged from seeds of radical ideas brought across the Atlantic from nations that spurned them into exile and from native tribal seeds. This new culture was uncomfortably germinated by various peoples who had come to stay, some as seekers, others as slaves, and its government was founded in revolution on the heretical proposition that all people should be free and equally rulers of the state. The ideal was always in conflict with reality. At times, the tension created brilliant advances in civil liberties. Most of the time, progress was slow, bloody, and often as not retrogressive. The major contradictions of the growing republic were its long acceptance of slavery and the remorseless extermination of native cultures, and ethnic cleansing repeated in other places in more recent times. One beginning today, perhaps, in around Turkey and Syria. However one might feel about the intrusions of Columbus and his successors, some celebrate, others bitterly denounce, European conquest of the Americas, Columbus's discovery began the end of the long age of seclusion of descendants of Asian hunters who crossed over continents until rising ocean waters cut them off from their parent cultures. The ancient cycles of pre-Columbian civilizations disappeared under the onslaught of invaders who were oblivious of them. In the same manner, more or less, sometime in the future, which already seems to have shortened immensely by threatened nuclear obliteration or poisoning the land, sea, and sky, sometime in the future, the civilizations that have grown from the ruins of the previous hemisphere monarchs will be devoured, deteriorate, or self-destruct. And in the words of Lafcadio Hearn, who favored the resurgence of Asia over the West, post-Columbian cultures that disappear from history, quote, will be as mist as the Ichthyosaur, unquote. Oregonians have a more personal tie to the great windbag, as Columbus was known to would-be patrons of his mania for exploring the Western Ocean and reaching India. No one should forget the Columbus Day storm of 1962. No one who lived through it will. A formerly famous Oregon writer and poet, Ellis Lucia, wrote a small book about the storm the following year, The Big Blow. This was his vivid synopsis before going into detail. On Columbus Day, October 12, 1962, nature went on a rampage as the most devastating windstorm ever to hit the Pacific Northwest rolled through Northern California, Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. It created the greatest single natural disaster to strike the West Coast in more than half a century since the destructive 1906 San Francisco earthquake and fire. The Big Blow was a freak that roared out of nowhere, gave little warning, and spread widespread havoc to cities, towns, hamlets, farms, and forests along a 1,000-mile corridor, 125 miles wide, and covering an area of 75,000 square miles. In a few brief hours of terror, the Big Blow resulted in 50 deaths in 3 states, injured hundreds of others, smashed homes, staunched buildings, industrial plants, barns, warehouses, airports, and marinas, knocked out thousands of miles of telephone and power lines, and uprooted untold thousands of trees, which were sent careening onto cars and fine homes. The pulverizing wind wrecked beautiful parks, wiped out familiar landmarks, and brought modern living to a standstill, forcing people back onto their own resources to survive, not for a few hours, but for days and even weeks. It gave them a graphic lesson in civil defense preparedness and what life might be like if atomic missiles started falling, which the following few weeks through October came perilously close to occurring, the Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962. What the bark beetle and fire do to the Northwest woods cannot be ascertained with any more accuracy than could be the force of the Big Blow. The powerful blow left the paralyzed region a shambles with losses amounting to $170 million to $200 million in Oregon alone, which received the storm's full wallop. The impact was a lasting one. The big wind left a permanent mark on private citizens, families, companies, industries, schools, churches, historical places, the men and women of the woods, government, the economy, on the land, and on people themselves in innumerable ways. The phrases October storm, Columbus storm, and day of the big wind will be around for a long, long while. And that was From the Big Blow by Ellis Lucia. The eruption of Mount St. Helens in 1980 generated interest in disaster plans and emergency services on the Oregon coast. The area's vulnerability was highlighted by a volcanic ash fallout that blacked out 2 Columbia River cities and fell on all coastal areas. The most likely disaster that could strike the coast would be the much-anticipated Cascadia earthquake and accompanying tsunami, which is a Japanese word scientists adopted for seismic sea waves. They were presumably irritated at the use of the term tidal wave, because the waves had nothing to do with tides. Later, it was learned that tsunami is the Japanese word for tidal waves. Tsunamis are usually generated by earthquakes or volcanoes and can also be triggered by nuclear explosions. The first tsunami of record wiped out Amniosis on the Mediterranean island of Crete about 1400 BC. The last tsunami to strike the Oregon coast was a wave generated by the 1964 Alaska earthquake that centered primarily on Anchorage. Although most damage occurred when the wave's greatest force struck Crescent City, California, just below the Oregon border, it wreaked havoc on its way south from Alaska. Several coastal bridges in Washington and Oregon, and undoubtedly along the British Columbia coast, were washed away or damaged, and at least one Oregonian was killed. The most common causes of tsunamis are submarine earthquakes or quakes in coastal areas. The train of waves generated by such an event contains tremendous energy and moves away from the area at high speed. These waves are long and very low at sea. Their length may be as much as 150 miles, and their height only a foot or two in deep water. They are almost imperceptible and pass under ships unnoticed. It is when they approach land that these waves become a terrible danger to humanity. The influence of bottom topography and configuration of the coastline transforms the low waves of deep water into waves as high as 100 feet. The waves that struck the Oregon coast in 1964 was estimated to have been 18 inches high at sea and 20 feet high when it hit the beach. The 1964 waves struck before coastal authorities had much chance to sound the alarm. The Seaside Warning System, which consisted of 3 one-minute blasts on the city's fire department siren, had sounded only 30 seconds before the wave struck. It was the same all down the coast. Warning had been insufficient to evacuate everyone out of danger. The wave also left a psychological imprint. Several false tsunami warnings were sounded as a consequence, and people evacuated coastal towns in fear of their lives. An initial tsunami warning system was set up throughout the Pacific Basin after a landslide in the Aleutian Trench in 1946 sent seismic waves crashing on several Pacific shores, including a few that ravaged Hilo on the island of Hawaii. This system, which consists of seismic stations scattered throughout the Pacific Rim, enables the size, destination, and estimated time of arrival of a tsunami to be broadcast anywhere in the Pacific, often giving local populations several hours' notice in which to evacuate threatened areas. The warning system for the Oregon coast has greatly improved and become more sophisticated since 1964, but yet seems far short of adequate despite considerable public anxiety the past few years. At least coastal cities that did not have evacuation plans or emergency communication systems have developed them. And as in Clatsop County, umbrella systems have been established to coordinate disaster relief between communities and between public and private emergency agencies. Clatsop County is also designated as a host center for the Portland area in case of nuclear attack. Unfortunately, the Oregon legislature abandoned a multi-million-dollar project to develop early warning systems for wildfires and earthquakes this past 2019 legislative session, which scientists say will endanger public safety and put Oregon nearly in last place of West Coast states preparing for natural disasters. Oregon Governor Kate Brown has said killing funding for expanding of early detection and warning systems ranks as one of the biggest disappointments, quote unquote, of this year's legislative session. It feels like the state is demoting public safety. There are lives at stake here, says Douglas Toomey, a seismologist and earth science professor at the University of Oregon, who is involved with early warning systems for natural disasters. Oregon is woefully unprepared, Toomey warns. The long-range but not far-off catastrophe humanity is sinking into, like deep mud, is Earth's change of climate that is occurring more rapidly than predicted. This is made evident by the desperate grab to fully control American politics by corporate and financial magnates greatly responsible for erosion of humanity's future on its ransacked home planet, the preposterously unlikely presidency of Donald J. Trump might be considered their prime triumph. But aside from desolation by drought, responsible for plethoras of deadly wildfires, forest-killing insect infestations and water shortages, abrupt cataclysms that are also palpable, not least of which is the patent certainty of a massive earthquake and tsunami due to rock and roll the Northwest Pacific coast between the next few seconds and when it does happen. The Juan de Fuca tectonic plate is burrowing under the North American plate. A huge earthquake is forecast, and not so long ago, scientists discovered that Northwest Terra is bulging, a sure sign of a quake building up like a big burp. Indian legends, until recently discounted as fairy tales, correspond with geographical data. Ghost forests of 300-year dead trees found along Northwest coasts were killed by tsunamis generated by earthquakes. Earlier eruptions and a few volcanoes raised up the Cascades. Most of Astoria would most likely be demolished in an earthquake. The hills will collapse into the river. The downtown landfill, which replaced wood pilings built out over the river that burned in the Great Astoria Fire of 1922, will dissolve like Alka-Seltzer. People going uphill to avoid tsunamis in the four-mile-wide river will meet the hills crumbling down. Schools and churches designated as evacuation and relief centers will probably be demolished. No streets left for fire trucks and rescue vehicles. Maybe no water except for the unpalatable ocean-flooded river polluted by civilization for two centuries. Worst-case scenario projection is a new ravage of volcanoes on top of Astoria's grave. Existing on top of the Cascadia earthquake subduction zone might compare to the uncertainty of virtually everything humanity is encountering, from pandemic pestilences such as Ebola, AIDS, or influenza, to consequences of its own invention and ultimate undoing, such as suddenly probable nuclear war or atmospheric fossil fuel and pesticide contamination. The stupefying election of Donald Trump as president of the USA is obviously an indication of the wrong primrose path taken. Uneasily, perhaps subliminally, seaside Northwesterners await the colossal earthquake and its accompanying titanic tsunami that is augured to wash the Pacific Northwest coast clean of us. No place on Earth is safe, of course, and most of us are more likely to be traffic fatalities or victims of random gun murders than tsunami or hot lava swimmers. Free falling through cracks in the ground, buried underneath rubble, or drowned by huge waves are seldom perceived as probable endings. The thought of Jack and Jillian down a crumbling hill into a seismic-lashed river is not sweet. The future earthquake-tsunami combination that is predicted for some time soon looms like a monstrous evil spirit over everything else when we think about it. We who live on this rocky, storm-swept coast remain yet stunned by the revelations of a history we hadn't known before. Our magnificent Pacific Northwest is doomed, at least for the short term, part of a cycle of earthquakes and tsunamis that seem to occur every three centuries on average. And not only do we learn that we are presumably to be the latest victims of a contiguous series of earthquakes and tsunamis, we discover we are at least half a century past the average for the next one. We are, as a whole, dreadfully unprepared for this overdue catastrophe. The ratios vary from 1 in 3 to 1 in 10, the chances of the dynamic duo demolishing our small society of beach towns during the next half century. We also have a failure of civilizations to communicate. We know about other perennial sites of natural disaster from the earliest periods of writing, and perhaps there are earlier records from as yet undiscovered cave paintings or rock inscriptions. There are records across civilizations, even. These perpetual places of calamity are doggedly recorded because most of the survivors return to rebuild after each recurrent devastation, such as the urban sprawl around Italy's notorious Mount Vesuvius, and those who remain to rebuild after massively destructive and lethal Ring of Fire earthquakes in Japan, Chile, and Nepal. We obviously can't leave out San Francisco's resurrection from earthquake rubble and fire, nor indigenous survivors of the 2004 Indian Ocean earthquake and tsunami who remain and wait for the next one if rising oceans do not refugee them first. But a portentous historical discount has lately been revealed between two disparate civilizations, one which invaded and essentially ravaged the other to near extinction in three centuries over an entire hemisphere. The dominating interlopers felt too superior to the cultures they displaced to pay much but token attention to their methods of recording history, among a plethora of other arrogancies. We know little of our predecessors' many thousands of years of history in these parts, assorted myths and a few bones and arrowheads to fill in the vast gaps of time in broadly general rather than specific narrative, until recently. Now, a few generations distant from their expulsion as hemispheric monarchs, we snobbish encroachers are almost pathetically interested in their experiences, especially with recurrent earthquakes and tsunamis. And so, just the day before yesterday, we have at last connected native myths with factual history. A few of those old tales that were scholarly derided or simply ignored have to do with a tremendous earthquake and subsequent inundation by a massive tsunami in about the year 1700 AD. The native stories are related in terms of generations rather than by calendar dates. Other signs have tallied with the old tales, such as tsunami-drowned forests calculated to have been killed by salt water 300 years ago, even a part of Japan that was drowned by a killer tsunami that crossed the Pacific Ocean, synonymous with the 1700 Northwest earthquake, which mystified the hapless Japanese until recently. They had not related to an earthquake on the other side of the world. Plate tectonics have enlightened us further about local earthquake and tsunami cycles. We live now with a death notice few, if any, of us suspected. Although several hundred thousand deaths and many thousands more injuries are predicted, it might be possible that most of us who live on the Washington and Oregon coasts, as well as Vancouver Island and the BC coast, might survive such a stupendous earthquake and tsunami combination, similar to those of the history we have recently been slapped awake about. After all, somebody obviously lived to tell the tales that have passed up through successive lifetimes to when the earliest humans, also interlopers as we are, survived a Cascadia earthquake and tsunami and passed on stories about the experiences. But in this case, it is our homes and communities that will be wrecked. Family members and friends will even most likely die if we don't. Probably, like survivors of other cataclysms, most survivors of our future earthquake and tsunami will rebuild along the new shorelines and riverbanks after clearing away the dead and debris of what had been their former lives. Our predecessors here likely did the same many times. And now, an article by Dr. Robert Brake from Ocean Park, Washington. Be kind to each other and our language. Aggravated by so many would-be patriots wearing Trump's red MAGA hats, Make America Great Again, I purchased a blue hat stating, Make America Kind Again. My mother didn't raise me to be a jerk, sucking up to power and treating others like dirt. Sure, go ahead and prosper, she advised, but mind your manners and don't pick on the poor. Good advice. So I embraced the politics of kindness, believing in decency, diversity, and public spiritedness, and refusing to hitch my wagon to intolerance. I find it difficult to live in a country where strangers seldom talk freely with each other, tell stories, air their grievances politely, and joke about this and that. It's hard to live in a country where taxes are cut for the rich, where services for the poor are stripped, where schools move to a four-day week, where our local libraries depend on bake sales, and where police and fire protection are sometimes outsourced while Americans realize they're living in the rye on the edge of a cliff. I prefer a country where people come to know and trust each other. All of us get knocked around and failure seems endemic, and some get a lousy hand. And what gets us through the woods is the kindness of others, their small good deeds, unbidden milk and honey. So let's extend ourselves to strangers, helping the lonely and the grieving, and not allowing shyness to get in the way of charity. Let's also be kind to our language, currently assaulted by Donald Trump and his crime family. Long ago, I noticed how Hitler's language rejected legitimate opposition. The people always meant some people and not others. Trump uses the word in this way. Encounters are always struggles, Trump says, winning. And any attempt by free people to understand the world in a different way is defamation of our leader, or, as Trump puts it, libel. Current politicians feed their cliches to television, where even those who want to disagree repeat them. Television purports to challenge political language by conveying images, with everything happening fast, with nothing actually happening. Each television story is labeled breaking story until it's displaced by the next one. So we're hit by wave upon wave, but never see the ocean. More than half a century ago, the classic novels of totalitarianism warned us of the domination of screens, the suppression of books, the narrowing of vocabularies, and associated difficulties of thought. In Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, published in 1953, firemen find and burn books. In George Orwell's 1984, published in 1949, books are banned and television is two-way, allowing the government to observe citizens at all times. While the characters in Bradbury's and Orwell's books could not surround themselves with books, we still can. Want to read? Try Fyodor Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov, or Philip Roth's The Plot Against America, or J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, an account of tyranny and resistance enjoyed by millions of young Americans. Revisit George Orwell's 1946, Politics and the English Language, Hannah Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism, published in 1951, or Albert Camus' The Rebel, also published in 1951. Try Victor Havel's 1978 essay, The Power of the Powerless, or Tony Jute's 1998 book, The Burden of Responsibility. Christians might return to the fundamental book, which, as ever, is very timely. Jesus preached that it, quote, is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God, unquote. We should all be concerned about what is true and what is false, being kind to each other and to our languages. And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. And that was by Dr. Robert Brake of Ocean Park, Washington. Be kind to each other and our language. And now, Genesis and Finale by Arthur Honeyman. In a timeless universe, on a certain speck of cosmic material, a phenomenon of individual activity evolved and separated from the oneness of natural forces, though the umbilical connection remained. Individuality destroyed timelessness forever, and it became a space problem, and it became a linguistic problem, creating and institutionalizing the meaning of existence and the deities to determine the fate that must be accepted at all costs, for those synthetic boxes shall crumble and experience the ravage of synthetic flames. Poof! Sometime about now, the nuclear hordes blast individuality into oblivion, mushrooming, vaporizing timelessly again, and imperialism disappears from linguistic rescue, so much for punctuating the burst of the bubble from within. Poof. As for me, I row, row, row my boat briskly down the stream. Merrily, 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 life reigns supreme. And this is Michael McCusker. Happy Columbus Day.